From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Emily Tamkin, U.S. editor for the New Statesman, Richard Lautendress, correspondent for TVA Nouvelle Canada, and our moderator is Shana Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. An unconventional convention. The Democrats officially nominate Joe Biden for president. How is President Trump responding? Plus, the showdown over mail-in voting. The head of the U.S. Post Office says he'll hold off on cost-cutting reforms that have been blamed for mail delays, but Democrats say it isn't enough. And the long-awaited report from the Senate Intelligence Committee on Russia and the 2016 election has now been released. We'll look at the findings, including a bombshell revelation about the president's former campaign chairman. Also, 100 years since American women got the vote. And a surprise presidential pardon. Emily, Richard, nice to talk to both of you again. Let's dig right in to the biggest political story of the week, the DNC party convention. The Democrats held their convention where they officially nominated Joe Biden to be the party's presidential nominee. Now, conventions happen every election cycle, but this year was very different, obviously, because of the pandemic. It was all done virtually. Emily, what moments stood out to you?
First of all, I was impressed with how they handled, I mean, just from a like technical or visual standpoint, was impressed with how they handled the virtual convention. I thought the roll call in particular was an effective use of these kind of strange times that we find ourselves in, where they had people like beam in from across the country and showcase their states while doing the roll call for Biden's nomination. The moments that stuck out to me, though, were the two Obama speeches, Michelle Obama's speech on Monday night and Barack Obama's speech on Wednesday night. Both tried to drive home two messages. The first was that Biden is a decent person. That's been kind of a motif of this DNC. And the second is that Trump is just not able to do his job, which is the other sort of, as I see it, core message of this DNC, which in some ways, I think with the inclusion both of Republicans, but also of Bernie Sanders and AOC and is trying to be all things to all people, kind of, right? The Democrats are trying to demonstrate that they're the big tent party. But the two messages that I think we're actually getting out of it is Biden is decent, and Trump can't do the job. And I don't think that anybody laid that out more effectively than the Obamas did.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack in your answer. And we're going to touch on some of the points as we talk about this convention. But Richard, I want to ask you the same question. What stood out to you during this week of convention?
What I found very interesting is I was expecting a lot of glitches because they were doing this virtually. And in the end, it went smoothly. It was pretty slick, especially on Wednesday night. I found that they did a good job in showing the diversity within the Democratic Party. We saw so many young people, even if there were some criticism towards the fact that they were not necessarily speaking for a long time, different younger faces, new people, more colorful, ethnically diverse, men, women all over the country. I think the roll call was very impressive to the point where having attended conventions in person myself, I think they should keep doing it this way. We could see the country. We could see the energy outside of Washington, D.C. So I think they did a good job in showing that the Democratic Party is much, much more diverse and wider than the older face of Joe Biden himself.
It's interesting because, Emily, you brought up, well, both of you really brought up this point that the Democrats were trying to show unity, this diverse, you know, group of people, big tent platform. But there were some cracks there. I mean, you've heard progressives criticize the fact that you heard from several Republicans speaking at the convention, but AOC, the progressive star, got 60 seconds. This sort of seems to be part of this larger challenge that Joe Biden has to both reach out to disaffected Republicans and moderates, but also to appeal to that progressive base.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you saw this as well. It's been a constant in the conversation about Joe Biden. It was a part of the conversation about who he would pick as his running mate, which group would he most appeal to with the choice. And now you have it again with the DNC. Like, who is this for, right? Is it for Republicans who are disaffected with Trump? Is it for progressives? Is it for people who are apolitical and aren't really sure what's going on with politics? And I found myself wondering while watching over the course of this week how this would look to somebody who doesn't cover US politics and foreign policy for a living, right? Like, if I think we're all very close to it. Like, if you just happen to turn on the TV, what impression would you get? Would it be that this is a party that's welcoming to everyone? Or would you get that this is a party that's trying to be all things to all people and therefore ends up being unsatisfying to everyone?
Good point. And Richard, I want to go back to what you said about how you kind of preferred this platform. But there's something also about having a live convention, because there are surprising moments in live conventions. The audience doesn't always cheer the speakers. And I wonder, we heard from Bill Clinton, who used to be a Democratic star. His star has fallen in recent years with the Me Too movement and his problematic behavior towards women. He spoke at the convention. I wonder if it was a live convention, if he wouldn't get some jeers. What did you think about that speech?
No, I think you're right, Shana. And to a certain extent, it helps the Democratic Party to avoid uncomfortable moments like this. Is it a good thing? I think at this very moment, to follow up to what Emily was saying, is it a party that try to appeal to a lot of people or to not, we don't know exactly who at large? I think the way they've done it is that they're really thinking as wide as possible, trying to reach as many voters as possible. So in the end, to give some space to Bill Clinton, as much as it's criticized by the Me Too movement, I think he still appeals to a certain generation, a certain type of voters. The Democratic Party, by doing it this way, and this type of virtual convention, helps the leaders, the party, but also the will of remaining a certain cohesiveness, so that the goal is to beat Donald Trump and let's just give a voice to everybody who seems to be thinking the same way to a certain extent, no matter all the darker aspects of their own life.
Right, but it also sets up the Democratic Party for more criticism if they're including people who some see as problematic. I want to go to the president's response to the convention, Emily. He tweeted furiously during Obama's speech, not surprising. He is very thin-skinned when it comes to the former president. What else did we hear from the president this week on the Democratic Party convention?
The tweets are at this point expected, and they don't necessarily disprove what the criticism of him is in this respect, right? Like if you're being criticized for not taking your job seriously and you go to Twitter and send out an all caps tweet, like, is that the effective response that you think it is? But the truly bizarre response was that, so Michelle Obama pre-recorded her speech and said that there had been over 150,000 dead from COVID-19. And the president said, you know, she recorded it so long ago that the number was wrong. Well, yes, now it's over 170,000 dead from COVID-19 because more people continue to die in this country from this pandemic. And you're the president. I'm sure we'll hear the full-throated response next week during the Republican National Convention. It didn't seem like they had the response lines down pat. But I also think that as the Democrats are trying to show that the big tent party, the Republicans, and particularly Donald Trump, are doubling down and saying, well, this is our base and we're going to appeal to them, we're going to appease them, and that is going to see us across the finish line for four more years.
You talk about the president appealing to his base or to people who support him. I want to touch on the president this week praising QAnon followers. He said, because they like me and they support me. And just to give an idea, some of the background about QAnon, it's a far-right conspiracy theory that basically says that Satanists, who are also pedophiles, control everything, and that Donald Trump is here to get rid of them. And a lot of the supporters have some pretty crazy, racist, misogynist, anti-Semitic views. How does this help the president by praising this group, Richard?
Well, obviously, he doesn't seem to learn his lesson. He was very much criticized after Charlottesville. The neo-Nazis and the extremists walking and chanting anti-Semitic slogan, and Donald Trump claiming that there were good guys on both sides. In this case, it's more or less the same thing. He seems to take for granted that if anybody supports him, this person deserves to be welcome under his umbrella, under his tent. I was also very surprised by the answer he gave to the question on QAnon supporters. The impression in the end is that he is trying to give its approval to very vocal supporters. Anybody who shows up and being very dynamic and active in their support, his or her support to him, he wants to hear them, he wants to see them around. So you're asking me, Shana, I'm trying to find a rational that would be further than just his own satisfaction of hearing people supporting him. There might be a ideological dimension to this support, but besides this, I think the president is simply trying to bring people to notice his campaign, talk about his campaign, even if it's in a controversial way, so that he attracts the attention and we focus on him instead of anybody else, anywhere else.
Yeah, it's who's supporting him, I suppose, doesn't matter what they're thinking. The last question I have on this, Emily, even with the president saying what he did about QAnon or other controversial comments he's made in the past, the economy is still in tatters, there's a pandemic raging. You still have polls showing that the race is tightening between Joe Biden and President Trump. So you're seeing the numbers sort of contract. It's not such a wide margin as we saw before when it comes to Joe Biden and President Trump. So what does that tell us about the race?
I think it says a few things. First, I think that perhaps people are getting used to this as our reality. And as such, there's less of a shock about, oh my God, the economy is so bad and there's a pandemic, and so I'm not going to vote for Trump, as people acclimate to this very bleak reality that we find ourselves in. I also think that it shows that we've been talking about Trump tweeted this strange thing and he said this strange thing and he didn't come out and denounce these QAnon people. And I don't know that it matters for him politically, because he has this 30% that's going to vote for him, and where they're distributed in the country helps him. I also saw some poll that said that like 50% of white voters are still planning on voting for Donald Trump, even with this economy and even with this pandemic. I guess we'll see in November whether Biden message is compelling.
There's really no other thing to say than we'll see, because as we learned in 2016, we don't exactly know how accurate polls are. Okay, let's take a break. When we get back, lots more stories to cover. We'll be back in a moment.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Emily Tamkin, U.S. Editor for The New Statesman. Richard Lautendress, correspondent for TVA Nouvelle Canada, and our moderator, Shana Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Welcome back. The U.S. Postmaster General now says he's suspending reforms to the U.S. Post Office after allegations and a massive outcry that it would slow down mail, it would disenfranchise voters who want to vote through the mail because of the pandemic. We saw the post office beginning to get rid of some mail sorting equipment and mail boxes. Again, the Postmaster General says this was part of a planned reform to cut down costs, but it comes at the same time that the president has admitted he wants to block funding to the post office to make it harder for people to vote through the mail. The president has been putting out there that mail-in voting leads to massive fraud. There's no evidence of that. So the Democrats made a really big deal out of this. You now have the Postmaster General backing off these reforms. Richard, did the Democrats get what they wanted?
I don't think so. I think at least he has stopped the damage that he had started to do. Louis DeJoy was suddenly at the center of all this. He was probably not expecting so much a backlash from what
You're talking about the U.S. Postmaster General.
That's correct. Let's not forget, he's a major Republican donor. I think the Democrats, it was not totally clear that the Postmaster General would go back to what was done, and mainly the Postal Service has been asking for money to make sure that they will be able to welcome all those people. We expect unprecedented numbers of people voting by mail because of the COVID-19 pandemic. The USPS has been saying that they do need much more help to make sure that they'll be able to do this. So is the Postal Service going to get the support, the money, the hundreds of millions of dollars needed to make sure that the mailing voting is going to happen happen correctly, that the votes will be counted in time for the November 3rd election. And knowing that the president keeps on criticizing, he is now, his campaigning is now suing New Jersey, who's going further on the mailing voting process. So I think the Democrats still have a lot to do to make sure that the Postal Service is not going to suffer from the Postmaster General decision.
I'm wondering here, Emily, what this story does to voters' faith in the legitimacy or integrity of the presidential election. Because as we've mentioned, you have the president saying that there will be widespread fraud if there's mail-in voting. You have the Democrats saying that Trump officials are intentionally trying to slow down the mail. Republicans countering that the Democrats are making a big deal out of nothing, that the post office can handle a surge of mail like they do every Christmas season, and this is just a manufactured crisis. There's so much political noise around this. How do you think this is going to affect voters' trust from both parties, their trust in the system?
It's a great question, especially because we were just talking about the polls tightening and come election day. And I think sometimes when we talk about polls, it's as though this is every other presidential election, and it's not. It's a presidential election during a pandemic in which many voters, particularly Democratic voters, if you believe surveys on who intends to vote what way, are going to rely on mail-in voting. While the president has openly said that he does not want to fund the post office, that Democrats cannot do universal mail-in voting, and also saying that that voting leads to fraud, which is unproven. But you are going to have Democratic voters and voters in general who worry that their vote will not be counted if they send it in by mail. You will have Trump voters or followers who are going to believe that votes that are sent in by mail are not legitimate. I think it's very concerning that his press secretary said the president will see after the election whether he accepts the election results if he loses.
And back to this point of there is no evidence of widespread fraud, but we did see an example of the chaos and confusion mail-in voting can create. In New York earlier this summer, there was a primary election there. Many more people voted through the mail because of the pandemic, and it took weeks to get the results. Many ballots were also disqualified. So, Richard, what could that mean for the general election? To Emily's point that president may not want to leave so easily, but it could take months for us to get a result.
Could take months for us to get a result. And it's also another opportunity for the president to challenge the result of the election. So the outcome is frightening to a certain extent, because even if the Postal Service was able to, as in Christmas time, manage the overflow of mail, still there could be delay, and any impression that something has gone wrong because of, could be a technical glitch, but some other people can see this as linked to any kind of fraud, it will damage. I'm going back to the question you were addressing to Emily earlier in her answer. It'll damage maybe not the integrity, but the confidence that the electorate will have towards the result. At this very moment, in this polarized political reality in the United States, I fear that the smallest little impression that something or somebody is behind this delay will have an impact on the way the other side, the losing side, will see the outcome for the winning side.
I want to make it clear, you know, some critics of the Democrats say that they're being hysterical over this idea that President Trump won't want to leave office if he loses, but it's the president himself who has been warning of a rigged election, and that's the only way he would lose if the election was rigged. So these are the president and the people around him, their comments on the election. I want to move on now to the coronavirus. Obviously, this is the big issue in this election. Where do we stand right now here in the U.S., Emily? I mean, the numbers seem to be slowing. The hotspots are getting a little less hot. We still have tens of thousands of people getting the virus. Every day, the numbers keep rising, but to a slower extent. But schools are beginning to reopen, and there is this fear that that could cause another spike. Some schools have opened already. What have we been seeing?
To me, the notable thing is that colleges and universities that tried to have their students come had to go virtual almost right away. You saw this at, for example, the University of North Carolina tried to do it in person and said, no, we're spiking. We have to go virtual. And to me, what this says is that even if the rate of infection is slowing, there are still over 5 million COVID cases in this country. There are over 170,000 people who have lost their lives to this. We still need to be very careful, because as we're seeing now in Europe, where a second wave is approaching, even if it looks like you have this under control, it is a virus, and so it can come back.
Yeah, and Richard, as Emily mentioned, we are seeing the virus coming back in some places. But can you give us a broader global snapshot where these cases are rising, where it does seem to be under control?
Well, it's interesting to see what is happening in parts of Europe, in France and Spain also. We've seen daily record increases in cases, which is interesting because we had the impression that they've been able to control the virus in a much better way than here in the US. Same thing in Germany. More, I think it's 1,700 new cases in 24 hours this week, which was the highest number since April. Another focus point is New Zealand. New Zealand, which is the, you know, like the number one in its class, the way it managed the entire crisis. And now we've seen a new cluster of outbreaks in the country. And you know that it's very interesting from North America, you were looking outside, and as much as we were worried with what was happening in Europe, they have been able to manage the things. But now you see new clusters in France and Spain. You look at South Korea, a triple digit daily case, I noticed this week. Japan also is worried on this side. So in places where we felt that they were controlling the virus, now it's coming back. Still, it's not as worrying as it was in March and April.
There do seem to be new cases, new outbreaks, but they do appear to be much smaller than, as you mentioned, the peak in April. And then you have several vaccines in development and health officials saying that they might be ready to go at the beginning of 2021, but polls also showing that many Americans won't take the vaccines. I think there's a Gallup poll recently that said 1 in 3 Americans won't take the vaccine. So that's obviously something we need to look at. We have a couple of more minutes and a couple more topics. So I want to move to the Senate Intelligence Committee putting out this long-awaited report, their final report on Russian interference into the 2016 election. It's a long report. It's nearly 1,000 pages long. A lot of details in it we've heard before from the Mueller report, but the biggest revelation concerns the president's former campaign chair, Paul Manafort. Emily, what does the report say about him?
It says that he was working with Konstantin Kilimnik, who is a Russian intelligence officer, and that Manafort tried to share campaign information with Kilimnik. I don't know if maybe the country is Russiagated out at this point, or if it's, you know, if they're lost in sort of the various players in this drama. But that's significant news that came out in the publication of this report.
Yeah, I think I agree with you on that. There does seem to be just a general sense of fatigue when it comes to anything that happens with Russia and the 2016 election, even though you have national security officials ahead of the FBI saying they're continuing to interfere and they're interfering in 2020. So it's still very much a threat. Richard, this was a bipartisan report. Both sides agreeing that there was Russian interference to help President Trump. It wasn't a hoax, as the president claims. But the president and his allies are latching on to the part of the report that says there wasn't enough evidence of collusion between the Russians and the campaign, and that the FBI essentially bungled its investigation into Russian interference, relying too heavily on the deeply flawed Steele dossier. So is this another example of both sides spinning a report to suit their own narratives?
And in the end, will more or less the impact of this report? Yes, I'm afraid that a long report like this one, as you were saying, almost 1,000 pages, makes the entire argument of this is so important and it should have a huge impact on the actual electoral debate not clear. What I mean is that you can already see conservative commentators hitting the FBI again and arguing that the president was more or less frame and all the way that so-called Steele dossier was managed by the FBI. My impression is that I think Emily said it so correctly. It's a big, important report, and still people are not going to be able to swallow its significance because it's going to be used in one way from one side by one side and one way by the other side.
And it's also overshadowed by the pandemic. Finally, this week marks an important milestone in women's equality. It's the 100th year anniversary of the passing of the 19th Amendment, granting women the right to vote. One of the women who was at the forefront of this fight for the vote, and it was a fight, certainly, was Susan B. Anthony, who was arrested for voting when women weren't allowed to vote. And now the president says he's pardoning her. Emily, tell us what we need to know about this.
I have just three things to say about this. The first is that while white women got the vote with the 19th Amendment, for women of color, and particularly black women, it was a longer and much more complicated story. Secondly, that Susan B. Anthony, when she was arrested, said she did not want special treatment and wanted to be met with the full force of the law. And third, that this pardoning came with the Susan B. Anthony group, which is an anti-choice group here in the U.S. And I think it needs to be seen in that context as well.
Fair enough. Although Susan B. Anthony herself was definitely a hero to many who were fighting for women's equality.
And yes, absolutely.
Yeah. It is also interesting. You sort of can't take anything out of the political sort of context here, the president is struggling to get the female vote, and this might be seen as a way to try to get more women on his side. We'll see if that actually works. Emily Tamkin, U.S. editor for The New Statesman, and Richard Letendresse, correspondent for TVO Nouvelle Canada, thank you to you both. That is all the time we have. Really appreciate you coming on and talking to us. This program is produced by the Voice of America. I'm Shana Stulen. Thanks for listening.